May it please the court, I'm here, my name is Teresa Seymour, I'm here with Jeffrey Garcia from my office. We are here today because of an accident that occurred, my registration number is 18420. We are here today, I'm representing the defendants in the underlying case, Mr. Kenningham and ANS, is what we call them, Accelerated Network Solutions, the employer. We're here because of a car accident that occurred on December 14th, 2007. Briefly, just to highlight the facts, Mr. Smith was driving a cab. Mr. Kenningham was driving a Honda Element. They were stopped at a green light at an intersection. It turned green. They entered into the intersection, both of them following each other. And right as they passed the intersection, the plaintiff's vehicle, the cab, stopped to no apparent reason to Kenningham, even though it was green and traffic was proceeding forward. Mr. Kenningham did not have any warning as to why the cab stopped, but his vehicle was not able to stop in time, and then he rear-ended the cab. Immediately after the accident, Smith got out of his vehicle and went to find what he told Mr. Kenningham was a person who was driving the wrong way on a one-way, and he was going to track him down because the man had left the scene of the accident. Mr. Smith admitted that he had never advised at the scene of the accident the investigating officers of this wrong-way vehicle going the wrong way on the one-way. He never claimed that in his complaint. He never designated that non-party person as a witness. It wasn't until the deposition of the plaintiff in October of 2010 that the plaintiff, Mr. Smith, went into great detail at how the non-party, the car traveling the wrong way on the one way, contributed to the accident. 3 days later, Kenningham designated the non-party, the wrong way, one way, as a non-party. However, plaintiffs objected, claiming actually they disclosed that in a cab investigation paperwork. What they didn't tell you is that the cab investigation work, even with that disclosure, was disclosed 22 days after the designated time for non-party disclosures.
Was so, that the day of the accident? Was there any evidence that both parties had communicated to each other about the possibility of a third party being involved?
My understanding from Mr. Kenningham is that Mr. Kenningham said, why did you stop? Mr. Smith said, I stopped for a vehicle that came out of the drive going the wrong way on a one-way, and I'm going to go get him. So he was out of his car chasing that driver down the street. Mr. Kenningham was only aware of that. He didn't know why he suddenly stopped on a green light in the intersection. He relied on Mr. Smith to tell him that.
And yet you have an abuse of discretion standard that you have to overcome on this issue.
Correct.
So how is that an abuse of discretion for the trial court to decide that parties had notice at the time?
I hope I can answer your question. Please. What I believe is the abuse of discretion is that the trial court really believed that the sudden emergency was not the wrong way on the one way, but actually the icy road conditions. Mr. Kenningham said, really it's not. It's the fact that we were proceeding into the intersection on a green light when this vehicle stopped for no apparent reason, and I didn't know why it stopped. So the actual sudden emergency was the fact of a vehicle going the wrong way on a one-way.
Which is also an abuse of discretion standard.
Correct.
But right now we're talking about the non-party designation. How is it an abuse of discretion on the non-party designation?
Okay, pardon me. With the non-party, so there was no evidence of the by the plaintiff of the contribution of the non-party, the person traveling the wrong way on the one way, until 22 days after the deadline to do that. The designation of non-party was due 90 days after that. They never provided that until July of 2012, which was after the time to designate. So when we deposed in October, that's when the first time that we had all the facts as per the horse's mouth, who was Mr. Smith, who said this is how the non-party or the wrong way, one-way driver contributed to the accident. So it was at that time, even if we had known the information from the investigation of the cab, we didn't have that information until after the deadline was passed. So when we asked for an enlargement of time, because we didn't have the information and the court failed to give us that, I believe that was an abuse of discretion.
Excuse me, counsel, since it was an unknown party anyway, and Mr. Your client knew that there was somebody else involved in the accident, why not, in an abundance of caution, file within the time limits a designation of non-party at fault?
My understanding is my client didn't see anyone. He relied on the statements of the plaintiff, Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith,
which is what you ultimately relied on anyway, in his deposition, right?
Right. But we
why wouldn't you have done that in time?
Well, we looked at the police report too, and there was no evidence of a third-party driver going the wrong way on the one way there too. So when they got to that point, when we took his deposition, that's where he went into the full, and also the disclosure from the cab company was 22 days late also. So we wouldn't have that either in time. So I think that if you give the benefit of the doubt to the person who's designated the non-party, and recognizing that when we took the deposition, it was 3 days later that we designated the non-party and requested for an enlargement of time, and were denied that request.
Now, you brought up the sudden emergency doctrine.
Correct.
You would agree with me that you have a bigger problem than that on that issue now, wouldn't you?
I would respectfully disagree with you. Better, and the reason is, Better says it only applies to cases in the future. It very clearly states that in the opinion.
Yes, but if we were to reverse and remand, wouldn't it apply on remand?
At the time of this accident in October of 2007, sudden emergency was a viable affirmative defense.
Correct, but wouldn't it apply to the new trial if we were to reverse and remand and send it back for a new trial? Wouldn't the trial court have to apply the new law?
No, I believe that it would apply from, no, because at the time of this accident, the time of the first trial, there was an availability from the defense. So I would suggest that the court would not apply Better. They would apply the sudden emergency. The problem is with sudden emergency, if they're not going to apply sudden emergency and they're not going to apply the designated non-party, that would go contrary to Better too, because Better says you have to have some way to distribute the contribution among the at-fault parties. So you can't do no sudden emergency and no designated non-party. One or the other has to give. So in this case, either you're going to get the sudden emergency and or the designated non-party, even with Better, or if you go to the case that was in existence at the time before Better, you would have the facts to substantiate a sudden emergency instruction by the court. After the continuance, after we tried the case, we started this trial on October 3rd of 2011. We went for 5 days. Mr. Kinningham then asserted, based on everything that he believed that could go wrong, went wrong, and there was evidence that was into place that shouldn't have been into place, and that he was denied a fair trial because of some things that were happened by the plaintiff. In anticipation of some of the problems that we had with our case, for instance, the alleged intoxication of Mr. Kinningham, we had filed a number of motions in limine so that we could allow our trial judge to bring this up front in the forefront and address these issues before we went to trial. And I think that was the proper way to do that. Judge, our trial court said there would be no evidence of insurance, there would be no evidence of traffic citation, there would be no evidence of VAC without proper foundation. You would proceed as follows, as far as the issues that you are going to raise, you want them to be clear. So when we started the case, the first thing that happens is plaintiff was asking questions about the blood alcohol contact of the investigating officers. We effectively shut that down because none of those officers could lay a proper foundation to talk about the BAC of Mr. Kinningham. However, plaintiff then requested Mr. Kinningham himself in direct examination or cross-examination, be it, what his BAC was. Over objection, the trial judge allowed him to answer, even though he was not an expert, He only knew his BAC from the issues from the court system being the DUI and things like that. That's the only reason he knew what his BAC was.
Doesn't that information go just to weight and not to admissibility, counsel? Can't an admission of a party opponent always be admitted?
I don't believe he doesn't know. He can't make the admission because it's not his admission to make.
Presumably you questioned him and showed that he didn't have sufficient knowledge, correct? Doesn't that go to just to weight and not to admissibility of the testimony?
Oh, correct. It should have gone just to weight. It should not have been admissible at all for any reason through Kenningham. I would agree with that.
I'm actually saying the opposite of what you're saying. Isn't it that the evidence was admissible, but what your argument is goes to the weight of the testimony?
I would make just a little finesse on that. I think the evidence is discoverable. I don't think it's necessarily admissible through Mr. Kenningham. It would be admissible if you laid the proper foundation with the investigating officers who did the DUI stuff. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
And actually you have 4 minutes left.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Good evening, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. With me today at counsel's table is Rebecca Albano. She tried the case from the Wilkinson Law Firm. My name is Tim Fowler. My serial number is 15983. It's a pleasure to argue for the first time in the new courthouse. It's a beautiful, beautiful courthouse. Thanks for the opportunity to argue. Thank you for the order on supplemental briefing on Medicaid. Very interesting issues there. Appellants have failed to show there's reversible error with regard to the merits in this case, and their failure is threefold. First, most of the arguments, if not all of them, lack record support. They either didn't preserve the objections sufficiently, did not give the trial court an opportunity to sort out the issues, and they simply have either presented, unfortunately, sometimes an incomplete statement of the facts, or sometimes a bit incorrect statement of the facts. And they typically, in their somewhat strident briefing, blame the plaintiff for a variety of errors, which are really not in the record. Third, they fail to show that the district court, Judge Martinez, abused his discretion. The abuse of discretion standard, as this court knows better than anyone, provides the trial court with considerable latitude in making judgment calls during trial, particularly with regard to evidence and evaluating jury instructions and providing for jury instructions. There's not a hint of abuse of discretion with regard to any of the legal arguments made as to the merits of the verdict and the judgment in this case. And if there was a hint of an error, it would be harmless. It would be harmless based largely on the facts presented and admitted both here today in argument and in the trial court and on defendant Kenningham's own testimony. Thus, the verdict is sound and should stand, and there's no basis to reverse the verdict. What happened in this case? As opposing counsel has lined out, let me highlight the facts that are particularly core facts to all the arguments that have been addressed so far. First, Mr. Defendant Kenningham went out to eat and then go bowling with his girlfriend and employee. They ate and then went out for cocktails. The word cocktails was used in opening by opposing counsel. He testified to it. He testified they were vodka sodas. He testified they were small, but he had 3 vodka sodas, hard liquor. He had those 3 drinks in 45 minutes. He knew it was December. He knew it was wintry and icy out. His counsel admitted the icy conditions in opening statement. Mr. Kenningham admitted in trial that he made the decision to drive after drinking the 3 vodka sodas. He said it was prudent. He said there was nothing wrong with it. He just testified in trial that he was impaired because of drinking. He testified openly at trial that he did not see the traffic or what was going on ahead of the taxi cab he ultimately ran into. He was not aware of the traffic or any driving conditions ahead of the taxi cab. Judge Martinez pointed that out very carefully in his analysis of the sudden emergency instruction discussion in the jury conference. That's well recited in our brief. Mr. Kittingham also testified he did not see Mr. Smith's cab except for the split second before he ran into him. He saw the cab stop. He testified he didn't see the brake lights, didn't see the yellow cab. The first warning Mr. Kittingham had about the stopping of the cab was when his girlfriend tried to warn him as they were going through the intersection, but it was far too late. These facts are not disputed, and opposing counsel has conceded some of them here today, as she must. Then Mr. Kittingham testified at trial, that, as discussed by opposing counsel, that Mr. Kittingham actually exited the vehicle, went over to check, and see what was happening with Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith told him in no uncertain terms, I'm going to look for, I'm running after the driver who pulled out in front of me. Then Mr. Kittingham testified in the same colloquy, same response, and it was a response to defense counsel's question. There was no impropriety by plaintiff's counsel. A question asked by defense counsel, what happened after the accident? He says, Mr. Smith told me he was going to go run after the other driver, and then I, Mr. Kittingham, returned to my vehicle to obtain my insurance papers. That was voluntary by Mr. Kittingham at trial. Thus, the notice of insurance papers in his car related to this accident came out through Mr. Kittingham's own testimony. Those are the critical facts, Your Honors, in my perception of the issues.
Counsel, can I ask you, the Bedore case, your learned opponent has said that can't be applied retroactively in this case. Would you please tell us what your position is?
Certainly. Of course, counsel would agree with the court that Bedore was announced in January of this year, just a few months ago. It did two things that are very supportive of our position, appellee's position, Mr. Smith's position. First of all, most directly your question, Your Honor, is the case came out. If this court was to remand for a retrial, of course the case is going to apply to a retrial. There's no other way it could be. That would be a prospective application. The case is being retried. You retry cases based on the existence of the law. You're not frozen in law. There's no retroactivity issue here whatsoever. Even if you were to apply the door, it reinforces the language in the other points we briefed, was that Bedore has very strong language about how sudden emergency operates, and that is that it cannot be caused by the party asserting sudden emergency as a defense. Here you've got a person who is admittedly impaired, driving in wintry conditions, and wholly inattentive. Kittingham caused a sudden emergency. There was no sudden emergency. Okay, Bedore has abolished. If it's a remand, at most, it would be harmless error. Even if Judge Martinez was supposed to instruct on sudden emergency and failed to, now with the abolition of the sudden emergency instruction, it would be harmless error at most. There's no retroactive. The other thing that makes it non-retroactive, Your Honor, is the simple fact defendants cited Bedore and argued it as a non-published opinion in their opening brief. They relied on it to say, oh, it shouldn't apply. That there is a sudden emergency, and Kendrick versus Pippen doesn't really control. They've already adopted and relied on the case.
They relied on the Court of Appeals decision.
Yes.
That's my recollection.
That's correct. If I misstated that, I apologize. That's what I was trying to say, is they relied on the Court of Appeals on published opinion, and now that the Supreme Court reversed it, I think they're married to it. Back to sudden emergency. There's no hint of abuse of discretion. The facts don't support sudden emergency. Judge Martinez pointed out, and in one of my footnotes in the brief, he points out that Mr. Kittingham didn't even see the traffic ahead of him. Mr. Kittingham did not see the other vehicle. He didn't know why the car stopped in front of downtown Denver. Cars slow and stop for traffic, pedestrians, or because they perceive a driving hazard all the time. There's nothing unique about that that creates a sudden emergency. That's routine driving. Plus, it's a rear-end accident. There's a presumption of negligence. Here we've got an impaired driver, admittedly on alcohol, driving weathered conditions, not paying attention. Judge Martinez was exactly right to deny the sudden emergency instruction. Did I answer your question on retroactivity, Your Honor?
Thank you. You may proceed.
Can we switch gears?
Sure, yes, of course.
Why isn't the employer in this case a prevailing party and entitled to costs?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. That's a very close question. The district court, I reread that order with that specific question in mind in preparation, because it seems difficult to say that a party who wins on directed verdict is not a prevailing party, at least in that regard. And we're looking from an abuse of discretion, and as I read the defendant's motion for prevailing party and the district court's ruling on that, it seems clear to me that what defendants did is they asked for too much, which they've done in some respects throughout the trial and perhaps in this court. But they wanted not just costs. They talked about costs, but they wanted fees under Rule 11. They wanted fees for groundless and frivolous conduct under 1317.102. They wanted fees. They wanted costs. They wanted this and that. And the district court judge's order is quite precise. And he says, based on what they asked for, they're not the prevailing party on all their claims for what they wanted. They fashioned their relief too broadly. They threw fees in. They didn't delineate it. They didn't narrow it down. And the district court, after refusing motions for new trial, motions for sanctions, I think said in his short order, well, I'm not going to award costs, fees, or anything, because you frankly aren't prevailing on the requested relief you seek.
Well, excuse me, counsel, if I may. Regardless of what the prevailing party analysis might be under Rule 54D, doesn't the statute 1316.105 require the award of costs to a defendant when it prevails on all of the plaintiff's claims?
Your Honor, the statute is rather clear in that respect.
All right, so
and I would agree that that's how the statute reads. I agree. However, I don't think they presented that to the district court in that fashion in their motion, and then the court denied it because they asked for too much blurred fees and costs.
Even if they didn't ask for it, aren't they still entitled to it?
That's what a remand would be for, Your Honor. Is that a fair response?
You may proceed.
Thank you. Let's talk about the designation non-parties briefly, unless the court has some other issues it wants to ask me off the cuff. I'll go, because they addressed that, I'll talk about for non-party. It comes down to this. A couple of basic points. The complaint was filed on March 24, 2010. This is the mini timeline. March 24, 2010. Therefore, by June 22nd, their non-party designation was due. Plaintiffs took the position because defendants were not served until May 17th, 2010, their non-party designation wouldn't be due until August 15th, 2010. So plaintiff already gave them, if you will, some, quote, slack in the timing and the deadline. I don't know of a court of appeals opinion that's resolved the difference between the procedural due process notions of no notice and the non-party designations due based on filing as opposed to service and then 90 days. We don't need to address that issue, but what's critical is they don't do anything. Defendant does nothing until October 26, 2010. Nothing until October 26, 2010. So, and they admit they got the CAB report that's detailed that talks about the third driver who pulled out the wrong way. They admit they got that in mid-July of 2010. Mid-July, mid-August, mid-September, mid-October, deposition, they wait till the end of October to do anything to designate a non-party. They've not shown necessity under the statute for an extension of time. They also didn't move or file within the standard period of time. They're late. They're late without even asking for an extension. They could have filed an extension and said, we want another 90 days. They didn't do that. They didn't designate. And what's more interesting is they pled it as an affirmative defense. If you look at the fourth affirmative defense, CD number 1, page 31, paragraphs 107 and 109, they say, we're not responsible because this was caused by parties or persons over whom we have no control and we had nothing to do with. There's two paragraphs very much like that. That's it all for all intents and purposes a non-party designation. If they had Rule 11 good faith basis to plead that, they must have known something, or they pled it in the blind, but nevertheless, they pled it. And then they try to blame the plaintiff for not having it detailed in the police report. The plaintiff was taken away by ambulance. He got out, ran around, came back, symptoms of his head injury started to ensue. Come on. He sat in his car, the paramedics came, and they extricated him and took him away. They don't dispute, they have the CAD report from mid-July. And the other alleged pandas, when Ms. Seymour asked, can you handle trial, and I quote, immediately after the impact between the front of your vehicle and the rear of the cab, what happened? What did you describe, or what did you see Mr. Smith do? Question mark. Paragraph. Answer, Mr. Cunningham. Quote, we got out of the car. I'm sure we exchanged. Are you okay? Are you okay? He ran in the alley, claiming he was running off. Someone just pulled out in front of him, and he was going to try to find them. Disappeared for a little bit. It wasn't very long. Came back to the car, and again, I think we exchanged a little more of, is everything okay? That's where I went back to my vehicle to look up my insurance papers. End of quote. CD number 2A, volume 1, Roman numeral 1, page 253, lines 12 through 22. Furthermore, defense counsel asked a follow-up question about the third driver, Mr. Cunningham. She asked him whether Mr. Cunningham had had an opportunity or talk to that driver, and Mr. Cunningham testified, no, he had not. That's at page 255. So, there's no question that there was notice. There's no excuse for not filing a notice of designation non-party on time, and the trial court certainly didn't abuse any discretion whatsoever. I have 5 seconds left. Any other questions? Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel.
Time is up.
Time is up. And we have 4 minutes exactly left for rebuttal.
Thank you. Very briefly, it's one thing for the defendant himself to believe, and in fact, contrary to the statements made here today, Mr. Cunningham did not believe he was impaired at the time of the accident. He had testimony from his passenger who said she did not believe he was impaired. He said, if I had felt impaired, I would not be driving at the time of this accident. As far as the designation of non-party in the Better versus Johnson case, or Beater, or however you say it, one of the things that I think we should recognize, or at least I had to recognize, is at the scene of the accident, the plaintiff never told the investigating officers about the wrong-way driver. But then he met with his insurance company, his employer's insurance company for the cab, and then he tells them that there was a wrong-way driver. And then, so we have a conflict of positions to the police, to the insurance company for the plaintiff. And then when I took his deposition, he was clear on what the non-party did in reference to causing the accident. Again, if you look at that Better versus Johnson case, you can't completely just disregard non-party, sudden emergency, and non-party. They have to, one of them has to give based on the Better analysis. Sudden emergency should have been given, and I think the trial court looked at a different case that recognized just icy road conditions only as a sudden emergency. Peek versus Forbes recognizes something that's almost identical to what we have here, and that there were 3 cars traveling from an intersection, and another car came from the wrong way out of a private drive, causing the first 2 vehicles to stop. And the 3rd vehicle, which would have been, in our case, Mr. Cunningham, was not able to stop because of the sudden emergency situation produced. With the ANS, clearly, I hate to say clearly, it's my position that they are the prevailing party. The plaintiffs had put enough claims. They had negligent entrustment, negligent supervision, negligent hiring, vicarious liability. However, at trial, they put no evidence of any kind on against ANS. They didn't call another representative of ANS. The only ANS representative that they had there at trial that they even asked any questions was Mr. Kenningham. And the only reason they had Mr. Kenningham there was to establish that Mr. Kenningham's company, ANS, purchased insurance for the vehicle that he was driving at the time of the accident. They followed up with one more question and said, isn't that liability insurance? We objected, the judge sustained it, and we moved on. However, by this time, we'd already had the information in about the BAC through Mr. Kenningham, attempts through the police officers that was not successful. And I think that in this case, there's no doubt that ANS was the prevailing party entitled to costs. One of the things we had continuously through the process had suggested to plaintiffs, you don't have a claim to establish any of the claims that you said, negligent hiring, negligent entrustment, vicarious liability, none of that applies here. We respectfully request that you dismiss that or we'll seek costs and fees for frivolous and groundless. That is what we did at the conclusion of the case when we had the dismissal and the trial court granted our motion for directed verdict following the plaintiff case in chief. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate your listening.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you both for your fine arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.